welcome to another episode of the Microsoft Spotlight Podcast with me, Andrew, and my co-host, John. This episode is proudly sponsored by BitTitan. Check out their website today to find out BitTitan can help you migrate your data to the Microsoft Cloud. So, John, another day, another episode. Can you introduce our guest today, please?
Yes, hi, everyone. Today we are welcoming Elena Snell, who is the founder and CEO of Teens in AI. So, hi, how are you doing?
Hi, John, and hi, Andrew. I'm very well, and how are you?
Oh, we're good, thank you. So, all the better for seeing you on video, because, you know, we enjoy, obviously, sharing video with all our guests, and when it works as well, because sometimes we've had a bit of a nightmare, but it's great to, you know, obviously see people's faces as well, especially in the world where, you know, you can't physically meet people anymore, and hopefully that's all opened up now, but it's just nice to, you know, put a name to the face and then hopefully meet in person in the future.
And are you based in London, John and Andrew?
Yes, so Andrew's based in the middle of the UK, near Birmingham, and I'm just out in Kent, so near London. I'm from London, as well as I was born and raised. So Elena, whereabouts are you from? Where are you based?
I'm originally from Uzbekistan, Central Asia, but I'm based in London, in north of London, so quite far away from Kent.
Not too far.
So we'll touch on that then. So like, obviously you from Uzbekistan. I can't even say that now. I'm saying absolutely terrible on this podcast. I'm rubbish with pronunciations. So what made you move to London? I'll go with that. What made you move to London?
What made me move into London? Well, that was a very long journey from Uzbekistan into London. Because before coming into London, I spent some time living in France, and then I spent some time living and working in the Balkans. In Africa, in Asia, in Bangladesh, and then I came into London. So that was quite a journey working in international development all over the world in post-conflict development, and then ending up in London just because I wanted to give a better future for my daughter. And I thought, you know, England was a really great place to settle, and my husband happened to be British too, so that helped.
That's awesome. So,
you've travelled, you're well travelled around the world, you are now in London as the founder and CEO of Teens in AI. Do you want to go over your kind of role at the moment, what Teens in AI is, and just give us a roundup on that, please?
Yes, absolutely. I founded Teens in AI back in 2018 at the United Nations AI for Good Global Summit. And we're on the mission to improve diversity and inclusion in technology, and specifically in AI. And prior to this, we had a different trading name. So we were effectively working in STEM and encouraging more boys and girls and from underrepresented backgrounds to explore technology in a really fun way. So we run hackathons, boot camps, accelerator programs. Now everything is done virtually all over the world. And as I speak, we're running a campaign in 20 countries around the world. To inspire more than 1,000 girls into AI for impact, AI for good, and that's what I do.
that's very interesting. So, like, what made you want to basically do that? You know, what basically drove you to then start going, I'm going to want to make a real impact in diversity, equality, get more women into, you know, the women in tech community. Obviously, you don't have to be technical to be a part of that. So, I'm going to touch on that because we already spoke, and I know that you're not an actual technical person, but so what made you, like, you know, really drive this you know, this campaign?
Well, the inspiration actually came from my daughter, who just turned 19 and just joined the tech industry at IBM. So it did work eventually, the inspiration and the drive. But when she was only 12, she was told by her teacher that computer science was only for boys. And I guess as a mom, I rebelled because we were in London. I was only just starting my business. And I was trying to figure out what to do because I wanted to do something in social impact, but I had no idea what I was planning to do yet. But my daughter kind of came home and said, oh, I can't choose computer science. I don't want to choose computer science. My teacher told me it's boring and it's just for boys. So I said, all right, well, let me show you how exciting it is and how it is really not for boys only. So I started taking her to hackathons for adults. And there was a Product Hunt hackathon running in 2015. So I thought, all right, it would be a fun one to join. It was not strictly tech, but it was everything else, business and entrepreneurship, design thinking. So we were hacking in different teams. And it was really fun. It took only 2 days to inspire my daughter. And she was asking me, when's the next hackathon? When's the next hackathon? And I thought, wow, that's amazing. 2 days, that's all it took to inspire my daughter into tech. And that was a very engaging way. She worked in a team, learned how to ask questions, doing design thinking, learned a little bit of coding, pitched her project to a bunch of investors, and she loved it. So I thought that should be available to all teenagers in England or in other parts of the world. And I decided to run my very first hackathon for teenagers. My daughter was part of it, and that happened in London in the offices of Rebecca Brooks News International here in London Bridge. And I had about 70 teenagers from Camden UCL Academy that came to learn about what hackathons were all about at this level. And a lot of the industry and mentors came to support, and judges came from Mike Butcher from TechCrunch and some angels and investors. Everyone was very curious to see what can teenagers really develop, what can they do. And everyone was surprised, overwhelmed, and asked me, can you please do more of this? Because, you know, we need this. Schools would really benefit from this. And every teenager asked me, you know, told me, I want schools to be like hackathons. That was really fun. Can you do more? and I just got addicted running more and more. And eventually I realized the future was with technologies like AI and virtual reality and IoT. And I thought, okay, well, this is not taught in school at all. And we started learning about it and then teaching it to the young people. So I bring in a lot of experts in AI right now, whether they're ethicists or technologists, to really demystify AI and show how technology can be used for something great. So this week and next week, we have climate change offered as a challenge, and we'll be seeing teenage girls all over the world trying to tackle climate change using data science and AI. So it will be exciting.
That's interesting. So literally, like, from your daughter being told that, you know, she can't do computer science, she then basically gone away and basically built a business from, you know, that comment from a teacher. That's you know, inspiring. And obviously what you've obviously done in the last, you know, so many years, you've just basically grew this business, and the fact obviously you're running this large campaign now, which is hitting like 1,000 people across the world, you know, is inspiring, definitely.
Thank you.
Yes, and we talk a lot of with other guests about kind of what do people need, what do young girls need when they're growing up in school to be inspired about going into IT, because they've always seen it going being boring, and that's kind of what I think we need to address a lot of. And I think you're hitting the nail on the head right here, what young girls need.
Thank you. Yes, I think it's been exciting. I mean, everyone moans, oh, we can't get girls to take computer science subjects or GCSEs, but I don't recommend girls to take any of these computer science classes, but I do recommend that they go out and participate in hackathons like ours. And there are others who provide similar facilities, because that's a really good setting and environment where they can put their coding skills to practice. So instead of just going and learning, you know, Python, JavaScript, whatever, they can actually first find the problem and then see if some technology will be able to assist or enable or help tackle that problem. So the way we work is quite different to just a coding school type program or a school itself. So we very much pioneer project-based learning. So what is the problem? How can we solve it then using technology? So the problem always comes first. And I think it does resonate with girls in particular, because sometimes we find when we have a multi-gender hackathon, or, you know, boys and girls and other genders, we find boys are very sports-driven into coding. So they just want to hack, they just want to code. Whereas for girls, what matters is really the why. And I think that's what I capitalize on. And I think when I also bring in other women who are non-technical into the room, they see then that technology is for everyone. You don't have to be a coder to be in tech. And there are some other really fascinating careers in technology that may not necessarily even need any coding. So a lot of girls that come to our hackathons, they're passionate about the problem, whether it's climate change or mental health or something else. And then somehow throughout the process, they figure out, wow, you can be a design thinker, you can be a project manager, you can be, you know, a machine learning engineer, you can be an AI ethicist. You can also be an entrepreneur and have your own idea. And so that's
just on that, like Andrew and I cannot code. I don't know, like I definitely cannot code, and Andrew is not a coder in his day-to-day job.
I like PowerShell, that's about it. That's as much as like code I can do. I like PowerShell, I'll do all day long. Anything else other than that, yeah, that's not for me.
But something we've said on previous episodes is that now that the IT market, the IT industry, isn't just, you know, geeky guys turning on and off computers, and we're far from that now in terms of an industry. As you said, there's plenty of other jobs, project management, sales, account management, et cetera, et cetera. The list kind of goes on. So what I was going to ask you was, you said you're quite well traveled, you've had quite a few different jobs around around the world. What skills and from those jobs do you think have really helped you in developing the career that you have now?
Probably communication and sales, because I have to pitch a lot to big corporates like Microsoft to try and convince them that the vision I have is worth investing into. So for me, the strength I think I have is, first of all, convincing people and getting people to say yes. So it's, you know, sales, but it's selling with passion, selling with storytelling, telling them, this is my background. I'm just an ordinary girl that comes from Uzbekistan, a little town called Bukhara, 300,000 people, you know, a very, very small town, when I didn't even know growing up as a teenager that I would ever have an opportunity to inspire other girls across the world to learn about technology, to learn about so many other aspects. So I think the fact that I came from a very humble background, but also traveled the world, and everywhere I saw was exactly the same. Young people's voices are not heard. You know, they're not really believed into. They're being told, first you go to school, then you go to uni, then you get your first job, second, third, and maybe at some point, you know, you will be somewhere high up, but that's not true anymore. You know, you can make a difference even at the age of, you know, 12, 13, and even younger, as long as you can help, well, you can discover your passion. And that's, I think, what I do really well. So first of all, I get people to believe in what I do. And then secondly, I bring a lot of people together to make something amazing happen. And it's the young people who drive. And I get the young people's voices heard in a way that nobody ever thought that young people can change the world in ways they can do using technology. So I suppose that's the power skill.
I mean, dealing with young children, you know, and people in their teenage years, it can be quite challenging. I know this from firsthand. I run an under-9s football team. And getting a bunch of 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds to actually listen and do what I need to do on the football pitch can be quite difficult. But I've been running this team now about 2 months. We've gone from basically losing every game to actually start winning. And that's because of, you know, constantly just basically just talking to them and listening to them and going, well, I can see you doing this, but have you tried this? And I think, you know, as soon as you start getting to younger people and basically start talking about what they can do and what they want to do, you know, you can inspire them to basically grow and develop, whether it's in an actual technical role, doing what me and John do, or then basically going down the lines of development, coding, or just as you say, like even the softer, you know, women in tech, you know, kind of roles as well, which is obviously, you know, being project managers and, you know, the world's your oyster. And as long as you get into younger people at an earlier age and start talking to them, you know, you can basically coach and mentor them, and, you know, they can go on and have very successful careers.
Absolutely. Totally agree. And we've had so many girls who would come as complete beginners. They've never tried any coding, and somehow 2-3 years we see, okay, so she started with zero, then front end, and now she's very comfortable in back end. And look where she is right now. She's studying maths and computer science at Bath University. So literally, so many stories like this, when we don't even advocate for girls to go and study computer science and maths, but they become so curious and interested, and they explore this field in such a at such a deep level that they get converted and they go to pursue computer science and maths in at university, because they know, okay, now I know why I'm studying computer science, because somebody in the family had cancer, or somebody else, one of the friends had you know, mental health issues, or somebody else has got something where they know that computer science degree or that computer science skills will be utilized and applied to tackle that particular problem. So we find if we go the other way around, the problem first, then girls know why they would want to go and study maths and computer science, because they there is a problem they want to tackle. So to me, that's really key, very important. Is that a cat you have, Andrew?
It is. So normally I close my door when I'm recording podcasts, but my kittens is home to join me today. So
lovely. Yeah.
But what I'm going to touch on as well, obviously, you know, because you've been doing all this work, you've been obviously receiving quite a number of awards for, you know, women in tech and the work that you've been doing. I mean, when you go basically doing this work, I mean, are you looking at receiving these awards, or this kind of just a bonus, basically people recognising the work that you're doing?
Most people that know me would say, oh, I don't know, you've just won another award. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. And I'll just get back to work. So for me, it's just, well, people recognize that's great that somebody heard that we're doing this work. People seem to nominate. That's also great. That's just recognition. An extra award just opens me open, helps me open an extra door. That's all I think of them. So I get an extra award. And in some countries where we're working right now, like in the Middle East and some Asian countries, an award or the fact that we have worked with Microsoft and MasterCard and NVIDIA and some of the other biggest brands, it matches to them, so that they can see your track record and they can do business with you. That's really all this is about for me. It matters not. I know that I am making an impact, and the girls and boys and other genders we're working with, they all are learning something highly impactful, something that they will use to hopefully change the world and be, you know, ethical, responsible technologists. That's really what matters to me. But an extra award that we win as a company or I as an individual just helps me knock on doors and open more doors and get more corporate companies and other companies to just help us, because we cannot do this on our own. We really do rely on corporate companies who would sponsor our programs, our campaigns globally or regionally or locally, so that this opportunity becomes available to the underrepresented communities around the world. In Kenya, we're working with teenage moms. In Palestine, we work with girls. In Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, again, because the events are often virtual or hybrid, we're able to bring in girls from you know, areas outside of the capital, so that it's accessible. It's you don't even need to be a coder to be part of a program like this. But we can only make it accessible and completely free for all teenagers is if corporate companies support us. So whenever we win an award, great, we're recognized and we're going to knock on the next big door, like, you know, another big company that will say, okay, such and such company have already supported us, must mean something. So come and join us as well. So, and gradually we just grow and we tap into the kind of areas that has never even seen anything related to AI or technology. Like, we've got a hackathon happening right now in Tanzania, in Swahili. Can you imagine AI and AI ethics taught in Swahili to a bunch of girls? Mm. Isn't that like, for me, it's a dream come true. But then I dream about crazy things like that, right? I want AI to be accessible to really remote areas. But the only way we can get there is by finding passionate people like myself who are local and will make this happen. So we train them. And then others like big corporate companies like NVIDIA, GSK, Sage, you know, MasterCard, Microsoft, who will say, okay, we will back you financially so that you have the capacity, the team to actually execute it properly and safely, because safeguarding for us, the most important concern when we work with girls in remote areas, we want to make sure it's a safe environment, that mentors, you know, in some countries, there is not even such a thing as criminal checks. you know. So we have to make sure we have enough teachers, enough moderators to supervise, to check that girls are in a safe environment. That is a very, very big task. So my team are literally working on this 24/7, doing risk assessments, making sure that everyone is safe, whether it's online or offline. So, yeah.
I've got a couple of questions for you then. So obviously, you've been running this for quite some time now. Is it the first time you've done this big global campaign?
No, this is the fourth time. But the first one, I think we only had 7 countries. And then the second one, I think only 12 or 14. Third one was last March. We had about 25. And this time also between 20 to 25 locations. And I think in Syria alone, we have about 3 or 4 cities engaged with every single hack, every single one of them doing a hack. But yes, we're hoping to grow to, you know, more than 100 countries one day. That would be an incredible dream to come true. So...
That's wicked. I mean, do you have any success stories that have basically come out the back of these so far?
Oh my God, lots of them, lots of them. So the winning team from the previous campaign in March, so that was run to celebrate International Women's Day. The winning team actually comes from France. So this was a global hack in 25 countries. And the 3 girls from France, they came to the hackathon with an idea that I think it was one of the moms in that team that was impacted during COVID. So she couldn't lip read when, you know, people are wearing masks and she has she's wearing hearing aids and she couldn't understand at all what was happening. And the pandemic, obviously, with everyone wearing a mask, it made it very difficult for people who have to have who have any hearing impediment to understand. And so these girls decided to develop a noise to text or speech to text, and I don't know exactly what they're using. I think they're trying different kind of technologies to see what works best, but it's a noise to text and it's a wearable that also has got some noise, and somehow it's translates into the app that they're developing as well. And that hopefully will help help people who have been struggling through this pandemic. And we don't know when the end of this will come. And maybe this could be also utilized in other ways in the future when the pandemic is over and we don't have to wear masks all the time. So that was the winning project in March. And the team, by the way, is now working in partnership with Microsoft Disabilities. I think they're based in France. They went through a vetting process or like competitive selection process. They got through and now they're being helped by a team from Microsoft because the team is based in France. I think they've tapped into some local connections. And there is a college Microsoft collaborates with who will help the girls develop the wearable device, which is in the form of a pretty necklace. And then the software is something that some of the other mentors are helping them with. So that's a really great story. And we really hope girls continue working on this project. And maybe we'll see this live soon. I don't know, but I know Microsoft has got a really great, you know, disability sort of I don't know, a group or
department.
And they're very, very strong and they seem to really like the project and they're very happy to help these teenage girls. And they're only, I think, 15, 16 and 17. So it's 3 girls from France, 1 based in Paris and 2 from outside of Paris. They've never met one another. They met at the hackathon and they decided, wow, that would be amazing to do something like this. So that's just one story. We also have teenagers who are incredible in Kazakhstan. I don't know how they teach teenagers there, but they all seem to be amazing coders in Kazakhstan. You literally give them a challenge and they build things very fast and in an incredible way. One of our summer programs had a project which had students from Egypt, a student from Egypt, 2 from UK and 1 from Kazakhstan. So 4 students are developing a device or an algorithm that will help predict or prevent or manage fire outbreaks, I believe, Ophelia. So that project, again, happened, it took them 3 weeks to build it. So it's a summer program which is run a little bit over a more extended period of time. And again, it's a very diverse team, two boys, two girls, completely, they've never met one another before. So they just met at the hackathon, investigated lots of problems that we have offered them, and decided to stick with wildfires, which have been, you know, breaking out quite badly recently. And in fact, during the time when they were developing, there was a really bad one in Turkey. So, and that is something, again, they're working on, but this is more to help fire brigades on operations rather than, from what I remember correctly. And another really exciting project that hopefully will go live and be launched. And the third one I can talk about very briefly is we have a partnership with Camden Tavistock and Portman Trust, which is an NHS trust specifically focused on mental health of young people. And we worked together since last year to develop an algorithm or a solution that will help young people here in London who are experiencing mental health issues to find the right support really fast, because mental health is on the rise, particularly now with pandemic. We've had a real increase in the cases. And so the Tavistock and Portman Trust have worked with a group of young people during the accelerator to develop something that hopefully will impact many other young people's lives and improve or help improve their mental health. So those are three off the top of my head.
That's wicked. You know, it's good that obviously something that was basically just an idea that's obviously making such a massive impact already. And so you've only been running these hackathons for a very short period. And, you know, it's been bought by, you know, some of the biggest companies to basically go and start developing it. And so obviously we had, you know, Donna Sakar on, obviously, who works in the disability space at Microsoft. And, you know, some of the stuff she was basically talking to us off recording, you know, it's just amazing. You know, what Microsoft want to do and how people are trying to achieve it.
That's amazing. Yes, I probably should connect with Donna, and she'll be very pleased to hear about this winning project from France, because I know there is a team from Microsoft that's helping the team, these girls, but they might be based in France, I'm not sure. But I think Donna will be very happy to hear about that.
So if you're not busy, come to the Safe Coast Summit. She's going to be there in person. Yeah. She's going to be on our panel that we're doing. So we're going to be doing a session about women in teams, but obviously focus on obviously the whole women in tech community. And I mean, one of the questions we got, John, it really, you know, bored my blood, and I was like, I had to share it on social media. But I mean, the whole point of obviously what me and John are trying to do is just promote, you know, women, the whole diversity, equality, inclusion. And I'm gonna keep banging on this drum. I probably said it how many times in this episode, on this podcast itself. One thing we haven't said in a long time, John, is the word spotlight. We need to bring that back. I mean, I'm you know, impressed with everything that you're doing. I mean, one thing you haven't mentioned to us at all, you're also a Microsoft regional director as well in the UK.
Yes, I am. It was actually Claire who nominated me to be on this podcast. She also was the one that nominated me for the regional director role at Microsoft, which is something I didn't even know about. I know about MVPs, but I have never heard about regional directors before. So I was very happy with the fact that she nominated me. It took me a long time to fill in the application because I wasn't sure, am I really the right person for this? Because I don't have any technical background, and I somehow felt that it was a very technical role. And she told me, no, you don't have to be. And so I filled in the application, then got a yes. And here I am. So every now and then, other directors, I think we have about 200 of us around the world. I do sometimes engage them in various campaigns, and it's a fantastic network. Every now and then, you know, they learn about what I do, and they're always very happy to support and offer any help that that we could really benefit from. So it's really brilliant. And
I didn't know what a regional director was until I think it was two episodes ago. We had Sharon Weaver on, and obviously she's a regional director over in Kansas, isn't it? Kansas,
yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Yes, there are only apparently 200 of us, but again, the majority, I believe, are still men. So so it's great to have women who we can bring sort of and use this to bring other women as well. And I think that's what happened. Claire nominated me, and obviously I want to also, I mean, there are so many I would nominate to help us as well with the mandate we have as regional directors. I think everything is about community building and just making an impact. So that really fits in with everything I do. So it's a great network to tap into.
So how come she went for AI over within kind of the scope of work that you're doing, rather than power platforms and everything?
Yeah, well, to begin with, it was just technology. We were, you know, building apps in Android and Swift or whatever. And then we decided to try AI because my co-founder, well, somebody who became a co-founder later on, he was a teenager at that time. Approached me as a teenager, telling me that he was trying to commit suicide six times, and asked me to please occupy his mind and basically give him something to do. And I said, well, I have no idea what to ask you for, because we just run hackathons. We are nothing complicated. And he said, well, that's okay. I can just like maybe rebuild your website or do something else, just anything, because I can't go to school. It triggers my anxiety and depression. And so I said, okay, well, tell me, what are you passionate about? And he said, AI. I said, okay, well, I know nothing about AI, tell me more. So he kind of told me, and I just could see that passion. And I said, right, well, let's run a hackathon in AI. And let's see what happens, because I'm not familiar with this technology, but you tell me, you lead on this. So he led on this project. And in 2017, we ran our very first hackathon in London in mental health. So that was the challenge. How can we improve young people's mental health? And how can we use technologies powerful like AI? It was a very, very interesting experience. And I could just see that kids were fascinated about so many different aspects of AI. And at that time, I had no idea about some of the problems that we're experiencing within the ethics of AI. And, you know, I didn't know about this, because this was all new to me. Every time I run a hackathon in a new technology, I have to become an expert in it as well. So I read a lot, I research a lot, and then I realized, wow, Cambridge Analytica happened. You know, a lot of other stuff I noticed that is happening around the world, where technology is being used for surveilling populations, or military wants to use technology and all sorts. And I'm like, wow, okay, kids need to know that that technology can also be used for bad. But how can we also make sure that from a young age, we can nurture that sense of responsibility? So with big power comes big responsibility. That's almost like the motto. And I dived into AI because I felt it is not just technology. It is a lot more than just technology. So when people say, oh, it's another technology like VR, like AR, and I always say, well, it's not. There is a lot more going on in the AI space than one would even notice or think about. So I felt it's important, if this is the technology that is going to shape the world, and pretty much every single industry will be somehow touched by it or affected by it, young people need to know how to navigate that space, and also encourage them to be responsible creators and designers, because we want more young people to get into technology, obviously as diverse as possible, a crowd, because we need all voices. But then if AI is going to be the one, or one of many technologies that will shape the world, then it's important that they understand how to navigate it responsibly and how to build it responsibly. So that's just how it happened.
I think we've grown up in a world where AI has always been done for bad, like the rise of Skynet and Terminator and the machines in, God, in the Matrix.
Let's not talk about sci-fi. That's exactly.
But I done an AI 900 partner-led thing with Microsoft, and the actual ethics and the mandates from Microsoft around AI, I kind of see how it fits in with what you're doing, because it is very much about using it for good, for the diversity, for making sure that things are fair and equal, and so it does fit in.
Yes, definitely.
I couldn't resist. Terminator reference in an AI discussion.
I'm not surprised. And also, when we ask kids, what do you associate AI with? The first thing they come up with is robots, Terminator, you know, all of this. And I'm like, wow, okay, that's all they think about. So, which is really a shame. But yes, on Microsoft and AI, we ran hackathons in a few places in the US, and we managed to get Eric Horowitz to come and do a talk on ethics and AI. And Etcher Kamari, and both of them are obviously very high in Microsoft within the Committee for AI Ethics. So it was very interesting to hear. And also, obviously, there were some disastrous cases within Microsoft, like Tay chatbot, right, came out suddenly and was throwing and hailing abuse at everyone when she just came out. And so it was great to see that Microsoft admits some of the stuff that happened within Microsoft ecosystem that probably didn't go as well as they planned to. And how do we make sure it doesn't happen again? And all of these case studies is something we bring up when we run hackathons, so that young people understand, okay, well, that happened and many other things have happened or are still happening. But how do we make sure, as a young generation, you know, who are really concerned about justice, about climate change, about, you know, mental health and various other issues, they really do care. This generation is absolutely incredible, I find. And if we can nurture and sort of channel that energy towards something responsible and something positive, then I think the world has got some hope.
I just want to put a spotlight on your co-founder. I mean, obviously he was a young lad and basically came to you saying, obviously he tried to take his life a couple of times. I was obviously looking for obviously someone to basically help him and just basically, you know, just be there and have that conversation. I mean, did that put you a bit on a spot and kind of took you back when he actually said that to you?
I was very concerned. I think my main goal with that young person at that time was I need to save him. I need to make sure that nothing happens to him. So I gave him a complicated task to kind of create a community of teenagers who we will nurture and nurture their interest in AI. And he was absolutely amazing at that. He's, I think, still very much grateful to me for keeping his mind engaged. It took him about, well, 2 or 3 months to pull this off, to pull off this project. And he was incredible. And by then, I think, the medicines have kicked in. He started his therapy and everything else. He was only 16 at that time. Now he's already got, he's studying for a PhD in AI. So dreams do come true. So he did his bachelor's at Imperial studying computer science, but already working in AI. So he's developing AI for fertility, which
that's,
is
that's incredible. A great story, that is. That's
yeah,
a,
so really AI story. Fertility, and right now doing his PhD at UCL, and he's only 21. a really, really inspiring young person, and he has this incredible ability to explain AI to a 10-year-old, which, again, a lot of people, you know, professors and, you know, machine learning engineers, you know, they know their AI and how to develop these models, but not everyone can demystify it to a 10-year-old. It's a very special skill, whereas he can, and which is amazing. So every now and then we bring him to our hackathons, and kids just get wowed and inspired and love it. So,
that's an amazing story. Yeah. I mean, mental health, you know, it's affected me and my family quite a lot. So hearing a story where, you know, someone's basically reached out for help, and that's one thing that doesn't really happen quite a lot. People just don't reach out. Well, this person's reached out to you. You then basically helped him, and obviously, you know, taking that, so that pride and obviously being able to help that person, and they've gone on and just, you know, achieved, you know, something beyond, probably beyond their own wildest dreams. Because we're obviously getting quite close to wrapping up time. I actually have a question for you, an actual interview question, because listening to obviously your story and what you're doing, you know, you're not a technical person. I mean, what did you see yourself doing as a career before you, you know, started doing what you're doing now?
My dream when I was a teenager was to change the world somehow. I was brought up
it's a big dream, that is.
It's a big dream, I know. So I was a teenager growing up in a post-Soviet country. There weren't very many opportunities. I was very lucky. I listened to my mom's advice, who told me, you know, learn how to speak English and that will open doors to you. So my native language was Russian. And so I spent a lot of time since I was about 9 learning English independently and with really good teachers. And we were just very lucky. We were a specialist English school in Bukhara, which is like a village, a tiny, tiny town. And we had some Peace Corps volunteers from America coming, and we were a chosen school for them to come and teach English. So I guess I was really inspired and I really wanted to learn a different language to be able to communicate with people. And being able to read books in English was just an amazing dream to come true. So I was very fortunate. I was able to access The Economist time when I was a teenager, reading about all of the horrible things that were happening in the world that I wouldn't get to know about or learn about because on Russian TV or Uzbek TV, we wouldn't get CNN or BBC or anything like that. So all my sources of what was happening in the world were coming from those papers. And so I think these are like building blocks. And also because I spoke English, I was able to volunteer and help. It's a very touristic place, Bukhara. So we have a lot of ambassadors and UN people and other people who work in the NGO world who would come. And every now and then when they didn't have a tour guide, and my mom worked in the museum for like 20 years being a tour guide. So most of my childhood was spent in museums, you know, in just kind of following her. So they would call my mom and say, well, we are short of tour guides in English. Would your daughter, and I was only 15, 16 at that time, would your daughter come and show us around? We have this ambassador from, you know, British ambassador coming with somebody from British Council, and we can't find anyone who speaks really good English and can show them around. So I was exposed and had a chance to communicate with people who are doing amazing things. And I thought, wow, I want to work in an embassy when I grow up. I want to work in the UN when I grow up, because I just was fortunate enough to be surrounded. And, you know, they say, you know, if you surround yourself with people, you become, you know, like if you surround yourself with 4 people similar to whatever it is that you want to be or surround yourself, then you become the fifth, like 25%. So I guess I had this very unique opportunity to be around those people, and they very much shaped how I thought at that time. And my dream was, wow, I want to work in the UN. I want to travel the world. I want to do this. So I got to do a little bit of that. And then I got disappointed about the system, about how corrupt the United Nations system was. And I thought, I want to build the world on my terms. So if I want to make a difference, it has to be something that I can design, that I don't depend on anyone else. And, you know, and it will be just down to my own values and foundations. And that is what I'm building. So I'm building something that hopefully will change the system and disrupt something within education. So if I can change education systems around the world, then my dream comes true. And if I can empower young people in their local communities to also make the change that they want to see in that community and in the world, then amazing, my dreams come true.
So even though, like, you wanted to change the world in another way, you're basically doing it now within your actual career, which you kind of fell into by accident. And that's just, you know, an amazing story in itself. And, you know, thank you for sharing that with us, because
thank you for having me.
When we spoke to Claire Smith, she basically said, like, you know, you'd enjoy speaking to Elena, because she's got a very interesting story. And yes you have indeed.
Thank you.
Another episode, another interesting different guest. So it's really good. Thanks for coming on the show today. And it was really good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure. And hopefully that inspires many other young people, or older generation as well, to do something great for their communities as well, and a bit for the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Cool. We'll catch you on the next episode. Thank you for joining us.
Definitely. Let me know when the episode is out and I will share it as well. All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Microsoft Spotlight podcast. Please make sure you hit that like, share and subscribe button to help us promote our message. You can also follow us on Twitter at MSFT Spotlight, and we're also on LinkedIn, the Microsoft Spotlight podcast. And finally, we'd like to tell you a little bit about BitTitan and thank them for sponsoring this podcast.
Remote migrations start here. Let MigrationWiz do the work for you. It's fast, secure, and 100% SaaS, which means you can migrate at any time and from anywhere. Migrate mailboxes, documents, public folders, personal archives, or even Microsoft Teams with just a few clicks. No special training needed, and no customer downtime. When the work matters, choose MigrationWiz.